So marketing, you can use it for all kinds of purposes. Sometimes you want to use it because things are going on in the world that you don't like and that are bad. Sometimes those things impact your community directly, like life and death. And sometimes you're going up against huge forces that are don't care whether you live or die. Sounds kind of dramatic, but it's how the world is sometimes. We don't encounter that too often in the United States, but it does happen. So we have two colleagues who I've had the privilege of working with over the years, one from New Orleans and one from my neck of the woods, the Hudson Valley. And in the Hudson Valley situation, at best rogue cement company wanted to put a cement plant right in the middle of a city near where I live in a rural area. They didn't want to scrub their emissions. They wanted to burn coal. They wanted to burn medical waste and old tires. Now, this town has schools, it has hospitals, it has farms. There was a whole economy there. This would have destroyed the Hudson Valley. This would have been the second biggest coal-fired cement plant in North America. You don't build cement plants next to cities. You build them out away, and you scrub your exhaust. These guys didn't want to do it. They had bought every politician, every media outlet in the whole region, and then they bombed the area with direct mail saying this was going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. And it was a done deal. And this was a big company with many, 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 many millions of dollars. And their pedigree is back in Europe during World War II, they ran cement plants with slave labor, right? So these are really nice guys. And not only that, they have criminal charges all over the country. These are horrible people with mountains of money going up against a handful of people. And we're going to talk about how we used our approach to life to prevail. We also have Sandy Rosenthal. And many people know that New Orleans flooded in 2005. Hopefully you realize it wasn't the hurricane that caused the flood. How many people know that it was not the hurricane that caused the flood? Okay, if you know that, it's because of Sandy Rosenthal. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and their public relations and every idiot on television was on the TV day after day after day talking about New Orleans under sea level. New Orleans shouldn't be there. We got to move New Orleans. New Orleans is the problem. No, the problem was the bad engineering that caused the catastrophic failure of the levees. That wasn't a big storm. It didn't even take shingles off roofs. But the levees, which were supposed to survive a five-level hurricane, didn't even hold up under a three-level hurricane. And a few thousands plus people died. Lives were devastated. A city was almost ruined. And the answer was, it's their fault. They should move. Let's turn it into a golf course. Let's just plow New Orleans under. And if you know that that's not the real story, that what really happened was the engineering problem, that's because of Sandy. So we're going to talk a little bit in the next little bit of time about how you use the skills that we have to fight impossible battles. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is so big that if you see a big enough pie chart of the federal government, they've got their own slice. That's how much money they have. And even Dwight Eisenhower, when he was president, said, I can't handle these guys. Now, they do good stuff, you know, here and there, but they're a big institution, and they're like all big institutions, their main job is to cover their own ass. And they were willing to cover their own ass at the expense of the future of New Orleans. That's unbelievable. But we fought back, and we won. So let's go with our friend from Hudson, New York, Sam Pratt. So Sam, what was it like the early days when it looked completely, there was no chance of saving the region?
Well, there was a very defeatist attitude around, and that was both because, you know, people tend to come up with excuses not to get involved, and also because the company and our local politicians were working very hard to squelch opposition in its infancy. And indeed, a lot of large corporations bank on the fact that, you know, while, you know, there may be some controversy for a little while, most groups peter out quite quickly, lose energy, run out of money, run out of time, and they thought they could slam this through pretty fast. And there was really just about 30 of us who had been fighting another type of toxic waste plant, a dry cleaning plant the year before, and won that battle, a very much more localized battle. This company at the time was the largest cement company in the world. It's the two brothers in Switzerland who owned the company were among the 100 richest men in the world, and they had always gotten their way everywhere they went. So they came in with a lot of arrogance, a lot of high expectations that they were just going to slam this thing through. And in a way, that kind of worked to our advantage because they really underestimated the power of citizen organizing.
Let's talk about the citizen organizing. So you started with 30. How long did this last, talking about people petering out and not petering out?
This went on for almost 7 years. My main co-conspirator and I thought that maybe it would actually never end because it went on for so long. But we didn't expect it to go on 7 years. We thought, well, maybe this will last 6 months to a year, you know. But really a crucial thing at the very beginning of the fight was to give other people a sense that this is doable. I was consulting to a group recently that's just in its infancy, and they were trying very hard to early on maintain a lot of secrecy around their group. They didn't want people to know who the leaders were and how big they were and what they were up to. And I very strongly advised them against continuing with that strategy. I said, people are scared enough about getting involved when there's a lot of money, a lot of political power behind a project. You know, the leaders of your organization need to project that they are fearless and that they're confident, and to give other people the confidence to get involved and put a lawn sign up and speak up at a meeting. So really a lot of our earliest work was, there was a ton of research to do because, you know, what did any of us know about the cement industry, burning coal and grinding up limestone at tremendous temperatures and polluting the atmosphere? I certainly knew nothing. I always said it's literally the driest subject on earth. So there was a lot of research going on. There was a lot of meetings in people's kitchens. But we needed to get out there early on and project this sense that, wait a second, not everybody supports us. We have a lot of questions, and we think, you know, this process should slow down a bit.
What I remember, and I'm sure you'll remember too, is initially people were afraid to voice their opposition because it seemed that everybody was for it, and that if you were against it, somehow you were a bad guy. Do you remember that?
Oh, absolutely. And the company was spending an absolute fortune. They ended up spending $60 million over a period of 7 years on this project and failing. We spent about $2.5 million, which, again, I never would have expected. You know, we were happy when we raised our first $25. But, you know, on the fly, we kind of came up with some interesting strategies. The company was spending a fortune on lawn signs and basically putting them on people's lawns without asking them or paying people to put them up. We started hand painting signs to project that these were actual human beings, not a corporation that opposed the project. But there was a lot of fearfulness that, oh, if I put a sign up, someone's going to throw a rock through my window, you know, or my tax assessment, I'll be targeted to get my tax assessment raised. And on the fly, we came up with some creative ways to get around that. I discovered that it was much less worthwhile running around trying to get random people all over the area to put up signs. I focused for a period of about 3 weeks on just a very small set of homes in a high trafficked area coming into town, realizing that if I could just get four people in this stretch or five people in this stretch to put up signs, it would get a lot of attention because everybody goes on this one road to get in and out of Hudson. And sure enough, you know, having just five or six homes agree to do it, all of a sudden people said, oh, I see signs everywhere. Where can I get one? Mm-hmm. And that broke our log jam. You know, the other thing I always said was, you know, I certainly had, you know, was very outspoken in the papers, in meetings, had signs plastered all over my house. And I said, look, if they're going to come after anybody, they're going to come after me first. And if anybody else hits a rock through their window, we'll all chip in and get the window fixed. So, again, there was a tremendous amount of just really bare bones, you know, person-to-person activism going on early, as well as, you know, this essential phase of saying, wait a second, this project doesn't have to happen, but let's slow down.
Yeah, I mean, and so people understand, too, the economic, quote, benefit, once that was figured out, it was going to add one new job to the region.
The company was basically closing another plant and moving workers from that plant to a slightly more modern one, which would need fewer people. So the net, even though they would be producing about five times more cement than their own plant, the net new jobs for the region would be, we were finally able to determine, according to the company's own application. That was one of our favorite tactics, was just using their own words, their own statements, their own track record against them, because then we could say, hey, you don't have to believe me, you know, greeny activist guy. You know, just look in there. You can look it up on page 87 at the bottom of the page. They admit they're transferring the workers in. There's only one job for a member of our community, and that's not worth it. And in fact, the pollution from the plant would have chased away a lot of business, you know, cleaner, greener business. So we eventually won that argument, but because of the amount the company was spending on public relations, it took us a long, long time to really, you know, break through. I would say it was probably took us 2 or 3 years to really break down that argument.
And local business owners who would have been devastated, because you don't move to the country to suddenly have a cement plant right next to your business. Even some of them were not ready to put their faces forward and say we're against this.
Right, but eventually we were able to organize a coalition of 200 business owners to sign on to a statement which said, not just we're opposed to this project, but here's what we support. This is the type of business we'll support. And in fact, the ruling we got at the end from the New York State Secretary of State predicated the ruling as much on economic grounds as on environmental grounds, saying essentially this is not the economic future of this community. And just to be clear, we weren't opposing it, you know, because we have some animus against cement per se. It was the scale of the project. It was the type of fuel they wanted to use, the less than state of the art technology they wanted to use, the proximity to a hospital, their track record that even if they built a state of the art plant, they couldn't be trusted to operate it and maintain it the way that was necessary. And the stakes were increases in cancer, increases in asthma, increases in heart attacks, and other health problems in the community. And a crucial factor was getting local doctors to join our fight. That was really a major turning point.
Great. And we consulted pretty early on in that process. And there's two lessons that I think are valuable to everybody. One is I said, look, the more you tell them, you know, there's an old saying in our business, the more you tell, the more you sell. In other words, don't be skimpy with publication. Just keep publishing and publishing and putting out more and like let it go, let it rip. And you'll actually do better than if you just send out slogans or postcards or signs.
No, that was a real revelation. When I remember very well, Ellen Thurston and I came down to your house in Tivoli, and we were direct mail novices. My background was in journalism, but I'd never done direct mailings. And I remember, if I'm quoting you correctly, you essentially saying, you should just keep sending out mailers so long as they pay for themselves, or even if you're losing a little money, because we always had a fundraising pitch in it. Yeah. We said, you're not trying to fund the whole fight based on these mailers. Just keep putting them out and say more than you think you should. You know, don't have a postcard size message. You know, there's a reason why. I guess I'm dating myself a little bit, but there's a reason why those record companies that used to send out all those direct mailers, you know, get five records for free or whatever. Why they had these mailers that were just full of, you know, one flyer after another. It would take you 10 minutes to unpack the whole thing, even though you're planning on throwing it in the garbage. And we didn't go quite that far, but we did really give people a ton of information, which projected not just that we've done our homework and the seriousness of this, but that, you know, this is something you need to take the time to focus on. You know, we also were really focused on a lot of activist groups. You know, everybody circulates petitions now primarily online, but very often not much happens with that petition. And we would not only be sending copies of the signature names to every decision maker and every elected official in the region every time we hit a milestone, 500, 1,000, 10,000, 15,000. I had volunteers who did nothing but just try to verify the addresses of the people who had signed our petition and send them a mailing saying, thank you so much. Here's a bumper sticker. Here's a list of 10 other things we need you to do. And here's the date of the next public meeting. And very often activist groups kind of fail at leveraging all the useful information that's coming into them in that way.
Mm-hmm. How big did the group get eventually? It started with about 30, and where did it max out membership?
We wound up with about 16,000 petition signers, which was, I think, a record for our county. It was only 60,000 people in the entire county, and that includes children. We had 4,000 paid up members, you know, people who had actually given us money, not just, you know, put a bumper sticker on their car. And we also set a record, I believe, with the Department of State, New York State, in generating about 20,000 public comments on a what's called a coastal consistency application. And I actually went up and reviewed all of the comments with my friend Warren Collins. And by the end, we had been told at the beginning that 95% of the communities for the project. In the end, when we counted up the public comments, they were 87% opposed to it, and not a single public official supported it, even though they had all been lobbied before we even knew about the project. So we did our work, but we also made it possible by extending the process 7 years. You know, companies very often want this to be condensed into a, you know, 6 months to a year and a half max.
I mean, it lasted longer than World War II.
That's true. I had not thought about it that way. How long did Vietnam last? I think we didn't quite get that far, but anyway.
You also did some fun stuff, which I love to see more groups do. Like you had a little parade, you had an annual picnic, you had an art show. Well, remember all those things?
Yeah, we did an annual cookout at the a local organization called the Federation of Polish Sportsmen, which neighbors where this 2,000-acre quarry would have been for the limestone for the plant. And, you know, it's just hamburgers and hot dogs out on a grill. But we would it was, A, to try to keep up the morale of the group, which was very important, especially when the fight was going on for so long. But also we would do specific projects there. You know, it wasn't just rallying people. For instance, 1 year I got a Polaroid camera and we set up a blackboard and we had people write a message about the plant on the blackboard, and then we take a Polaroid of them in front of their message, and that became yet another thing that we could send out to public officials and say, hey, these aren't just random names on a petition. Here's the real live people. You know, we'd encourage people to bring their dog with them for the photo or their kids. And, you know, people often ask me, well, how do I write a letter to the governor? How do I write a letter to somebody at the state environmental conservation agency? And I say, the first thing you need to tell them is who you are. You know, say I'm a grandmother, I'm a school teacher, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse, whatever your role is, you know, because those are the letters they pay attention to. If you just send them a form letter that says, count me as another person opposed to St. Lawrence Cement or concerned about what the Army Corps is doing, you know, that gets weighted very differently, especially by politicians, than, you know, something that's on your own stationery. I know, you know, almost nobody writes letters anymore, but that's probably the last true, last remaining purpose for having, you know, actual real stationery.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, to take a group from 30 and get it up to 4,000 paying members and to sustain it for 7 years. I remember that when we won, there was a party at a club on the second floor. Do you remember that? On Warren Street?
It was a building in Hudson. It was a private space, but it used to be a department store. It's now a private business.
But I remember walking around at the party and I'm like, really? It's over? I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it finally. Because I assumed that it was never going to end, that it was going to be a 100-year war.
That was also right in the beginning of Bush's second term. I think John Kerry had just lost a few months before when we won. And so people were really pretty depressed about the state of the nation and also, I think, discouraged about the chances of actually winning these things. But, you know, it was Republicans who killed the plant in the end. You know, we had a Republican governor, Republican secretary of state, Republican congressman. We never really gave up on anybody. I mean, I've always been a Democrat myself, but, you know, it was crucial. One thing I wanted to say before I turn it over to, and I'm happy to keep talking, but it's really crucial in these fights to remember that your neighbors who are on the other side of the issue are not the enemy. It's the company. It's the regulators. You know, we were just absolutely unsparing in our criticism of the Swiss owners of this plant and the outsiders that they brought in to manage their public relations and their marketing and their legal work and their engineering and everything else. Again, they spent $60 million primarily on lawyers, consultants, and PR. You know, and so we would be absolutely vicious in our criticism of them, but we would not go after, you know, members of our community who had unfortunately been fooled by this company into supporting them, because we always wanted to flip them. You know, that was the most powerful thing you could put up there on a TV was I used to support the plant, but I changed my mind because I realized they'd been lying to us. And really that was a core element of the campaign, was just relentlessly attacking the company's credibility. Mm-hmm. They came in with a lot of firepower, a lot of facts and figures, a lot of, you know, paid consultants from national firms. And, you know, I think we were pretty successful in, over time, just chipping away at their credibility till everybody just said, you can't believe any of their promises.
And in fact, they weren't credible. Nothing's credible about that company.
No. But they're now merged. They bought the second biggest cement company in the world, and now they're even bigger than they ever were. It's a company called, it was then called Holderbank. It's now called Holcim Lafarge. And they got through all the antitrust stuff, and they now are more giant than ever.
Okay. Yeah, I'd forgotten that element. I think it was so important. You never made it a community neighbor. It never became neighbor against neighbor. It was, here's the facts. We'd love you to join us, but right. That was great.
Well, because it was a core part of the company's strategy. Because we're close to New York City and we have a fair number of weekenders in the area, they decided for whatever reason that their strategy would be to say, it's only city people. It's only rich city people mm-hmm. who are against it. And people who grew up here support it, because the area used to have cement plants. Of course, they were a completely different animal, much smaller, more locally controlled. They were pretty dirty, but they had a very conscious divide and conquer strategy. And we just decided, rather than trying to buy into that, you know, or trying to fight fire with fire, that we would rather just make the company the enemy and just keep trying over and over again to get officials and neighbors to join us. We got some of the most staunchest political supporters of the plant to come around, you know, in the last year or so. And our city council rejected the idea as well. So, you know, that was gratifying. And it also was important because, you know, you didn't want to win with a scorched earth policy. Exactly. If you win, you leave this just incredibly scarred community.
Exactly. Well, thanks for sharing this story with us and giving us. Yeah. So we're going to turn it over to Sandy, and I hope you stay with us. And
yeah, I want to hear all about it. I'm fascinated.
Okay, great. So now another hopeless. I mean, we could almost say that this looked like, on paper, this looked like a hopeless battle, right? I mean, David Goliath. I mean, Sam, just as a wrap-up, I mean, this started out as a David and Goliath situation.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. So here's another David and Goliath story, maybe even bigger, because the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they buy all the cement. And like every big group, they just cover their own ass, even when they make a mistake. And they made a big one in New Orleans, and they were happy to let the people in New Orleans pay for it. And not only that, demonize the people in New Orleans in the process. There's a lot of connections between the Hudson Valley and New Orleans, you know, because the Livingstons funded Fulton's steamship, and the steamship is what made the Mississippi Valley productive, because it only flows one way, unlike the Hudson, right? So you needed an engine to go upriver, right? Also, it was a Livingston that negotiated the Louisiana Purchase. So there's a lot of really tight connections between New Orleans and the Hudson Valley historically.
I'll jump in there and mention, if I might, there's a woman who's a neighbor of mine up here named Roberta Brandes Gratz, and I think she's living primarily in New Orleans now and wrote a book about New Orleans. I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
We're Still Here, You Bastards
was the name of the book. We're Still Here, You Bastards.
She has a, what's now her, a second home in the Hudson Valley, so that there's somebody who actually literally bridges the two worlds.
Cool. Okay, so we're going to turn it over to Sandy. So Sandy, what happened? How'd you get involved in this?
Well, Hurricane Katrina, as I'm sure you all heard of, it did not actually hit New Orleans. We only got the east side, which is the weaker side. Hurricane Katrina actually hit Mississippi and did enormous damage. But in the case of New Orleans, the levees broke in an amount of storm surge that actually was not significant. It was 3 feet below what the levees were designed to hold. But the Army Corps of Engineers did what they did best. They went into full damage control after the levees broke. In an environment, and this is key, an environment where 80% of the city had flooded. So people like myself were trying to find out, where am I going to live? How am I going to make a living? And where are my children going to go to school? This is a perfect environment for you to be fooled and for you to be told what happened when actually you're too busy to take care of anything except yourself. So in this environment, the Army Corps of Engineers put a lot of money into a disinformation campaign. They blamed the strength of the storm. They blamed the geography of the city. They blamed, all we do in New Orleans is party, and we philandered all the money and squandered all of the money, and that we deserve what happened to us. And the Army Corps has deep, deep pockets, and they almost got away with it, except for me and my son, who was 15 years old at the time.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And tell them about the internet sock puppets that were operating out of the Army Corps of Engineer offices.
The most amazing things can happen when you're not expecting them. And this was December of 2008. I decided, let me see where all these nasty comments about me are coming from. I was being daily slandered, disparaged, discredited on my own personal blog, on my blog that I had with the local newspaper. And I'm sure everyone here knows what an IP address is. So I thought, well, let me see where these IP addresses are coming from. And at that time, I used a website called Who's It? And it only took a few keystrokes to find out this was coming from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And I thought, well, I wasn't surprised by that necessarily, but on the other hand, I felt like I'd seen that IP address before. That numbers kind of stick with me. So I typed in the IP address into my own personal blog and my own, I'm sure everyone here knows what stat counter is. It's a way to figure out how many hits you're getting. And using stat counter, available to amateur bloggers like myself, I figured out, this individual is Army Corps of Engineers because of his IP address. So if A equals B, B equals C, then A equals C. These people slandering me are using Army Corps of Engineers federal equipment to wage a disinformation campaign against me and my group or anyone that supported me. So I picked up the phone in about 1 second, and I called the local television station. And the rest is history. They were literally caught, and it was like a caller ID at that time. But this was, remember, this is 2008, online warfare. We didn't know what that meant yet. Now everyone knows what AstroTurf is and what online trolls are. I was one of the very first victims of such online warfare, and the reason is simple, money. If the Army Corps of Engineers could be sued, we were talking billions and billions of dollars, and that's what this was all about.
And there's one other twist to this. They had been posting to the local newspaper. They're hiding their identity, and I'm just Joe Blow Citizen, and I'm outraged at these partying New Orleans fools living under the sea level. They should, grow up. So the newspaper had a stack of records. You want to tell this story? Because it's pretty, or you want to keep it?
I'm not sure exactly what you're
talking about. They disappeared. Remember the guy got fired? The guy that collected all those records at the newspaper?
Oh, okay.
I mean,
here's how
the news operates sometimes.
Okay.
It turns up, I found out later on, that the Army Corps of Engineers did not act alone in their disinformation campaign. This should come as no surprise to Sam that the Army Corps of Engineers coordinated their campaign with the local media. So when after I had made this discovery, IP addresses, they're nailed, I went to the newspaper and said, let's print out all these copies, all these comments. I wasn't interested in who these individuals were. It's all about, we're not going after individuals in our own community. I had no interest in that. But I wanted to understand the extent of this activity. You know, is it a couple of comments or is it hundreds? Is it thousands? So the editor of the local newspaper, his name is John Donnelly, he actually did a printout. This is, don't forget, this is 10 years ago. We did printouts back then. He printed them out, and only a six-week period, because more than that, the system crashed. So he only was able to look at a six-week period, and in just 6 weeks, and this is after the Army Corps of Engineers colonel had told his people, do not do that activity anymore, it continued, and in just a six-week period, there was thousands of comments coming in, disparaging. So right after this happened, and after John Donnelly told me over the phone about, we had a phone conversation, we were testing... some sort of chatting that we don't even have anymore. He said, he told me the extent of the comments, and I went, wow, this is a Friday night. I'm so excited. I can't wait till the following Monday because I wanted to see them all. That following Monday, Don Donnelly wouldn't answer my phone call. He wouldn't answer my email. This went on for a week, and then I found out he'd been fired. So... And
the documents disappeared.
The documents are gone. So they, and then right after that, NOLA.com changed their entire platform that they use for posting the newspaper to make sure that people like me, amateurs, could not look at IP address and figure out these relationships. So that was one of the saddest things. But on the other hand, we now know that the campaign existed. I mean, they can't. Yeah, maybe we'll never get the comments, but we know the extent of them. So again, the Army Corps did this in cooperation with the local media.
So these guys are playing hardball.
Yeah. First example of fake news.
Yeah, it's an early one. It's a really well documented. It's fake news, trolls, the whole bit. And that was, it started in right after, I mean, right. Dead bodies were still floating in the water when these trolls were on, blaming the people in New Orleans for their own tragedy. Well, there's so many things I would put on it, but since you opened that door for me, so we started working in early 2006. So the challenge that levies.org, which is the name of the organization, is that people get, first of all, there was just the trauma. But no matter what happens, about a year later, people start drifting away. Sam encountered that, right? I mean, you have to do something to keep people engaged, keep their morale up. It's not going to happen by itself. So you kind of had hit that peak, and it was starting to come down the other side. So we met, and we talked a little bit.
Right, and what Ken taught me was to utilize the YouTube, utilize all of the social media available at that time, and he taught me some tricks of the trade, which I never would have known. You know, even though we were a tiny little grassroots group, every time we did a YouTube video, it ended up on YouTube's homepage, most watched, most viewed, most commented on, because I used Ken McCarthy's, I call it your secret formula. And I think at the end of the day, it's about using the techniques that are most, that are cutting edge at that time. And this was, at this time, it was 2007, by the time you showed me the YouTube how to utilize YouTube, and I'm very grateful for that, because utilizing the internet was how we did it. When I started levies.org, I wasn't even living in New Orleans. I had to evacuate like everybody else did, and I was living in a city 3 hours outside New Orleans.
And you became an information source, like a font, an endless font of information. So you talk about that?
Right. That ties into what you said this morning with fundamentals and really understanding, reading and understanding everything about the particular field that I want to talk about. So I learned, I read, I learned. The more I learned, the more questions I asked. And then eventually, it didn't take long, I became an expert in this field, which is critical for success, becoming an expert in what you're doing.
And then how did you engage and enroll and involve other people?
Well, I took your advice. Ken suggested you need to have more face-to-faces. Because, yes, the internet's great. You can respond to emails at 2 o'clock in the morning. But still, you need to have face-to-face. And so for 3 years in a row, we held what was really a fun party. I hired a jazz band, and we had food, and we had beer. And we had a chance, everybody, to get together before we had a little business. And we did this at the anniversary of each of the, I don't call it Katrina, the word in my book, which is, my manuscript is finished, I don't use the word Katrina at all. Because in my mind, the flooding of New Orleans was levee failure. So I don't even want anyone to think about a weather event. I want people to think about levee failure. And for 3 years in a row, we did one of these, for lack of a better word, parties every year.
And you also had a PSA program, a public service announcement program, and talk about that.
That's another one of Ken's suggestions, which the moral of the story is do whatever Ken tells you to do. So if he says do something, you do it. Ken suggested, and at that time, all of the television stations were required by law to do public service announcements for free if you could provide a broadcast quality footage, which we did. I went out and I hired a local videographer, and we created two public service announcements, one of them by Harry Shearer, well-known of one of the voice of The Simpsons, and the other public service announcement was by actor John Goodman, who turns up as a part-time resident of New Orleans.
Great. And let's talk about media. So we've talked about the chicanery of the local paper, but you also had to turn the entire world news media around. And how did you do that? Because here's the problem. You know, the first person that gets the story out usually wins. And if they do it with a barrage for unanswered for several months, I mean, you don't have a prayer. And yet, you won. So the story was Katrina did it. The act of God. What a tragedy. And those damn New Orleanians, they're so reckless, they're so irresponsible, they party all the time, and they live below sea level. Who could care about them? That was the story. And that went on for months. Turning that around really hard.
Years that went on.
She did it. How did you do it?
Well, it was a lot of things. You know, the public service announcements, these YouTube videos. It was lots of things, but always something. I like to think something fresh and new in my mind, something new. But one of the very important things that we did right from the very beginning was we got together a crew of letter writers, not from New Orleans but nationwide. And in the case of New Orleans, so many people were displaced and moved away and never moved back. Meanwhile, their heart was still in New Orleans. That they joined these letter writing teams, and I would go through the newspapers every day or online every day, find an article that had the story wrong, and then boom, send to this team of letter writers. I call them sharpshooters, and we call them the CAT team or counteraction team, CATS for short. And they were a very critical team in helping turn around the message about New Orleans, because Boston Globe, New York Times, Sacramento Bee in California, whenever one of these major papers would tell a story wrong, we got this team of letter writers to write to them instantly. I mean, you had to respond right now and from all over the country just to tell the story right. And we trained each of them. I created a video, put it on YouTube, and gave it a terminology that it's private, that only certain people are allowed to get it. And this also works for other things, but YouTube works out quite well. And we trained each CAT, we called them. And this team is still working today, by the way. It's something that, and we replenish the writers about every year or so.
And you continually still have to, but you succeeded. The Times has stopped talking about Katrina, the Washington Post, the CNN, the BBC. It's all changed.
The major papers have stopped what we call the Katrina shorthand.
Yeah. And you have a point, a question?
First of all, good on you.
Yeah.
Honest to God.
Thank you.
You downplayed our lunch conversation. How did you get the CAT team together? How did you find them?
I pulled them from my database. And so one of the first things I did was create a database of supporters. And that, real quick how that started, I was such a novice, and it was embarrassing for me to talk about it because I was such a newbie and a novice. But I thought, well, I need to have levies.org, to have this organization. I need members. Well, how am I going to do that? Oh, I know. And I asked my son, who I created levies.org with my son, who had just turned 15. But kids know everything, and he knew how to create a website. And we wrote a petition to President Bush asking him to keep his promise that he made in Jackson Square to build New Orleans back stronger, or the levies back stronger. And we put the petition on the website. I remember I went to bed on a Sunday night and sent it to all my family and friends and said, sign this petition and send it to your family and friends, which is the true grassroots group at work. And overnight, we had 200 signatures, and that's how it started. And this 200 became 2,000, became 10,000. At our peak, it was 25,000 nationwide. So we pulled these letter writers from that base.
Great. Okay. Well, Sam, thank you very much. I've always wanted to get you two together. Figured out a way to do it.
I'm really psyched to know about your story. That's great.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Great. Thank you. You too.